Years after the fact, John Foster Dulles admitted that when he was Secretary of State, he'd made a mistake in acting hastily during the Suez Crisis and blamed his rashness on jet lag. Jet lag has been blamed for everything from presidential clumsiness to Olympic diving board mishaps and even to an increased susceptibility to malaria. On this week's Please Explain, we'll try to find out what causes that zombie-like feeling and what we can do to fight against our bodies and the clock. And joining us are Dr. Kevin Gregory, a former NASA jet lag program scientist and the current vice president of Alertness Solutions, and Dr. David Rappaport, director of the sleep medicine program at NYU Medical School. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Hello.
David, is there a biological definition of jet lag?
Well, I think that the simplest way to think of it is that jet lag is when your body's internal clock is not in phase with the light cues and the time of day that we have experienced outside our bodies, and so that most typically happens when you travel across time zones, and that's where the word jet lag comes from.
But is there an official medical name?
Well, we call it a phase delay or phase advance when your internal clock is not in phase with the outside clock.
Oh, we I like jet lag better.
We don't use the term jet lag in the same way, but it's so widely used that I think they're synonymous.
Now, is it connected to sleep disorders?
Well, it's generally considered one of the sleep disorders when you have a phase advance or phase delay, and that can happen through external cues that, for example, when you travel, or it can happen through a variety of medical conditions where your body clock is not functioning quite the way it's supposed to.
Kevin, doesn't it have something to do with the suprachiasmatic nuclei, the SCN in our brains?
The suprachiasmatic nuclei, yes. That's the marker for the circadian clock, the body clock.
How did we first discover that the SCN was responsible for jet lag?
I'm not familiar with that history. Perhaps David can
tell. Do you know?
Well, I'm not sure that I can give chapter and verse about exactly when or how it was discovered, but it's been known for some period of time. And the way it's been proven, if you will, is that people who have lesions or damage to that area, whether in an experiment because of in an animal or because of some kind of a stroke or vascular accident, these people seem to freewheel. They don't have the clock ability, which is so important to setting our biological rhythm. And while I can't tell you exactly when that was first discovered, it has been known for a while, and it's now a completely accepted fact that what you essentially have is an internal clock, which is set in that area of the brain by light. And so what happens is light shining on your eye gives a signal, and it's a kind of a timing mark. There's a day, and then there's a night. And through the suprachiasmatic nucleus, that gets turned into a 24, slightly more than 24-hour rhythm of wake-sleep, and that's present not only in humans but in most animals, and is a very critical part of what synchronizes us to the day. Now, what happens is that rhythm, if you don't get any external cues, for example, blind people, or at least certain types of blindness, they don't get any light cues. And if you, as an individual, are put in an environment where there are no light cues, you will tend to freewheel, so you'll be in sync with the clock that you're looking at part of the time, but then over days you'll drift apart from it and you will no longer be in synchrony with the outside world unless you do something to entrain yourself. And that's what light does. That's why light is so important in keeping us in synchrony with the outside world.
Now, I've heard that we have circadian clocks in all over our body, like our livers, not just
That's relatively recent and absolutely correct. It turns out that the mechanism for this clock rhythm exists at a cellular level in many different organs, in our intestinal tract, in our liver, in a variety of other bodies. But what seems to be the case is that there's one master clock, which is the one in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which sends out signals, and then it brings all these other clocks in line.
Mm-hmm. Because the circadian clock for our liver, I gather, also makes it easier for us to process alcohol at nighttime than during daytime. And I've always wondered about those people who are in a jet and are drinking wine at 10 o'clock in the morning, whether they're doing a good thing or a bad thing.
There are probably other reasons why that's not a terribly good idea, because it is one of the things that can make jet lag more of a problem is alcohol. But that's probably not due to the biological clock in the liver. The whole issue of biological clocks is not very well appreciated and wasn't studied until quite recently, but we're now starting to ask questions. I don't think the answers are known, but we're asking questions about things as simple as, should we give chemotherapy for cancer at certain times as opposed to other times to get the maximum benefit and the least side effects? And that would be related to these kind of things of metabolism and clocks driving all those things.
Now, Kevin, we're often told that jet lag affects us stronger when we're traveling west. Then is it when we're traveling east rather than when we're traveling west?
Yes. Actually, one of the studies we did back at NASA is we looked at pilots who were flying long international flights and studied them at a sleep lab when they were at their layover spot and found out that the pilots who were flying east had more problems sleeping. The sleep was more sporadic as opposed to pilots flying west who had a better sleep period. And it was more uniform as far as the timing as well.
So, and do we know why?
Well, I think that has to go, like David was talking about, the circadian clock tends to run a little longer than the day. So when you go west, your day is actually lengthening. So the clock kind of likes going with that. And I think most of us find it's easier to stay up a little bit later than to go to bed earlier. So I think the going west works in that regard as opposed to east, where you get somewhere and you have to wake up earlier than you're used to waking up, and that makes it hard to start your day there.
Well, next month I'm going to go to Italy, but I'm going on an overnight flight. Is that a good idea?
If I
can sleep.
Right. I mean, there are different strategies to try to use there. I mean, you can try to sleep during the flight. I flew to Europe just a couple months ago and found the economy seat didn't work too well for that. The other thing is, you know, if you get there and you're really tired, you can maybe take a short nap. But one of the other things we recommend when we're talking to people about things like this is that first night, at least, you've got a lot of sleep pressure, as we call it, built up, and that can help you sleep at least that first night when you're, you know, now six, eight time zones away from home.
What about taking melatonin to help us sleep? Is that a good idea?
Well, again, this is a very controversial issue, and I think most of us who advise patients don't use melatonin, although it is, on the face of it, the natural way to go.
Because it's the hormone that controls our circadian clock.
That is what
it
is essentially the way that the clock communicates with the rest of the body, we believe, is there's secretion of melatonin about 2 hours before you go to sleep. It reaches its peak. And so if you're going to use melatonin, first of all, you have to be aware that since it's not generally considered a drug by the FDA, it's not controlled for the most part. And most of the melatonin you buy in a health food store is of variable strength. You don't know what you're getting. And so it's hard to talk about doses, no matter what they say on the label. Generally speaking, what's sold is much stronger than what's needed. The body uses very small doses. And so we generally use a small dose of melatonin, half a milligram, 2 hours before sleep, if we're going to use it. And the only place that has been shown to work particularly well is in the situation of blind people, where it substitutes for the light cue. It is directly linked to the light. A better way is probably to use light to try and drive your own melatonin. And then incidentally, if you need sleep help, we now have fairly good sleeping medicines with very few side effects. And generally speaking, it's probably more effective to take 3 days or so of sleeping pills, mild sleeping pills, short-acting, at the right time that you want to sleep in the new time zone, rather than trying to shift your body clock. Because just forcing yourself to sleep at the right time and then getting sunlight during the day at the new time zone will bring you into sync at the rate of about 1 hour per night. So you can move one time zone per day. The other thing that's very important is to realize that while we talk about time zones, people have different sort of activities that keep them up. And if you start planning for your trip by going to bed at a slightly earlier or later time, depending on which way you're going, you can already start the process before you actually travel and have effectively less time zones to adjust to. So we generally recommend that 2 or 3 days before your trip, you start going to bed either an hour or 2 hours earlier if you can, or much more easily, an hour or two later than you normally would, depending on where you're going to be afterwards.
I'm talking with Dr. David Rappaport, Director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU Medical Center, and with Dr. Kevin Gregory, a former NASA Jet Lag Program scientist, currently the Vice President of Alertness Solutions. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're talking about jet lag on today's Please Explain It, and invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Kevin, we were talking about some strategies. You advise people, everyone from business travelers to Olympic athletes to NASA astronauts, on how to manage sleep and avoid jet lag. But you discuss the Henry Kissinger approach. What does he do?
I'm sorry, you've got me on that one.
I've just read about this. Henry Kissinger's method of he changes the hour you wake up and go to bed before you travel, and then make sure that he schedules meetings at times that are convenient. But what do you tell people to do?
Well, one thing that David was commenting about was adjusting your sleep beforehand. One of the things we often recommend to people is, don't start your trip, as we say, in the red by losing sleep. Unfortunately, what we found in a couple of projects we've done with some business travelers was the worst night of sleep they got was the night before they left home.
Mm-hmm.
So they start off the trip already tired, which, exacerbates the problem once you get to where you're going. So one of the things to try to do is, get some good sleep before you go.
Maybe try to go to sleep early?
If you can. Certainly depending on, what direction or where you're going to be headed.
Well, watch a
and
boring
again,
movie. Watch a boring movie and then fall asleep at 9 o'clock?
Or maybe try to read a NASA report. That can do it as well. and light is light, again, is a critical part of that. And if you apply it kind of at the right times of day at your new destination, that can help accelerate your clock change to the new destination, maybe a little bit quicker than the standard hour a day.
Yeah. Why do scientists and doctors study jet lag? We know the cause. We know the effect. So why are there still so many jet lag programs going on around the country?
Well, I think that probably there are two reasons. First of all, because despite all of the advice that we give, it takes time to adjust. Your internal clock doesn't shift overnight. It's very, very hard to move it by large amounts. And anybody who's been to Australia or to Asia from New York knows that. It takes up to a week or sometimes more to get fully in sync with a new time zone if it's a big change.
And then you're coming home.
And then you're coming home. And that, by the way, is another trick which may affect businessmen who travel very short periods. If you're actually able to travel, and if your travel is for 24 or 48 hours to another time zone, it's sometimes actually better not to shift and try and stay on your native time zone if your business opportunities can be moved to something closer to allow that. Not shifting and then avoiding bright sunlight, which will shift you and make the trip home harder by wearing sunglasses and so on, is important. But the other part to your question was, why do we study it? Well, it turns out that jet lag is only one form of this problem. The much more important and common, at least numerically important, problem is the issue of shift work. And we have a lot of people who work nights. And so they'll work 3 days, say the midnight to 8 a.m. shift, and then they want to have time with their families and their friends the other 4 days of the week. They'll be on a day shift. Well, those people are undergoing something very similar to jet lag because they're forcing their body to work at a time that the internal clock says is sleep time, half the week, and then as they begin to adapt to that and shift to it if they're able to, then they're switching back to the other time, and so it's very much like a trip to Europe followed by a return every 3 or 4 days.
Kevin, what did you study at NASA's jet lag program?
We mainly looked at aviation, and I think, you know, why do people study it in that regard? It's certainly a safety issue, safety and performance issue. You've got pilots flying here and there. And, you know, earlier David was talking about the idea that a clock can go to free running. In one of the studies we did, we found that many of these long-haul pilots, their circadian clock was running about an hour and a half longer than the standard rhythm should be. And in some cases, the pilots had no detectable rhythm at all. So you can see how multiple time zone crossings, say, in a week, 10 days' time, is just really putting them, you know, in a freewheeling, out of whack kind of situation, such that, you know, in aviation, there's something called last leg itis, where sometimes that last leg home, they're affected by their sleep loss and fatigue and maybe making some decisions that aren't the best because they just want to get home and get some rest.
What about astronauts who have no light cues at all?
Yeah, that's a very tricky environment because they basically have like a 90-minute light-dark cycle. We did some work with some people there. There are people at Johnson Space Center that are particularly focused on that.
Well, David.
Yeah, there's a whole other area of interest, which is if you must sleep and act, you know, actively work at a schedule that's not 24 hours, what's the best strategy? And there are a lot of occupations where that's an issue. For example, long-distance solo sailors. There's actually a circadian researcher who has done a lot of sailing himself who is interested in this. And the problem was that if you're alone on a boat sailing across shipping lanes, you don't want to sleep for long periods. And so you force yourself, and the Navy has a long tradition of having shifts that are 4 or 8 hours long. So they try to force people to sleep on a shifting schedule. And there's a whole study of this that is, you know, slightly different from jet lag. We call this circadian rhythm research, where you are trying to force the body to have a sleep-wake cycle that's not 24 hours long.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls and also going to your comments that you've been posting on our show page. My guests are Dr. David Rappaport, Director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU Medical School, and Dr. Kevin Gregory, former NASA jet lag program scientist and also current Vice President of Alertness Solutions. Our number again, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
I guess that's come better than Devo's record Jet Lag. My guests are Dr. Kevin Gregory, former NASA jet lag program scientist, current vice president of Alertness Solutions, and Dr. David Rappaport, director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU Medical School. We're talking about jet lag on today's Please Explain and getting lots of calls at 212-433-9692. This is something most of us have experienced. Amy from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The guest talked about using sunglasses to keep from being too affected by being out in the daytime. But I've read that that sunlight on the skin also has an effect. Is that
okay? Both of those are interesting comments. The use of the sunglasses in a good sense is to try and minimize that effect that we have through the eyes of bright sun if it's coming at the wrong time. So if you're trying to shift your schedule and prevent a burst of sunlight from entraining you in the wrong way, sunglasses are a very important part of that. We recommend that to anybody who has shift work and wants to go home and go to sleep, that when they go out in the morning, they don't want to get a bright burst of sunlight because that will sort of wake them up and get them into daylight mode. And so they wear sunglasses on the way home if they plan to go to sleep. If you're in a time zone where the sun is striking you at the wrong time, or if you go to a country where, for example, in summer there almost is no night, if you go very far north to Iceland or somewhere like that, they have a nearly 24 hours of sunlight or of dark, the sunglasses can help you. As far as the skin being a receptor, this is suggested by some experiments. It's not anywhere near as strong an effect as the direct light on the eyes. The most of it is through the retina.
Do people ever adjust this to shift work because there's always going to be that dark light problem for them?
Well, again, as was pointed out a little while ago, there are very different biological behaviors. Some people have a very strong biological clock, and others people have a much weaker clock. And it doesn't seem to be that that's necessarily bad for you. It's just something you seem to be born with or perhaps can change slightly. And the other thing is that there's a big difference in how badly people respond to being out of sync. Some people have no trouble, and others people have a lot of trouble. In general, younger people seem to be very, very easily changed, and they don't have a problem with jet lag that's anywhere near as great. As we age, our biological clock becomes weaker and seems to be a little bit less able to entrain us, and also we suffer the side effects of being out of sync. I know personally, I never experienced jet lag till I was 40, and around that age, I began to notice that it was much more of a problem than I had felt when I was younger.
Vicky from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, we adopted an infant in 8.5 months from China and obviously changed her time zone by 12 hours. So I was wondering if you were aware of anything at a certain developmental stage that might permanently or semi-permanently affect the brain. She's had almost free-running circadian rhythms since then, and they've only very recently and very slowly begun to settle down to a more normal rhythm.
How old was the infant when she came over?
8.5 months.
Yeah. Actually, infants, newborns, don't actually entrain to a day-wake cycle until they reach probably a little younger than that, and that still takes a little while to develop. That's why newborns, you know, they have to be fed every 3 to 4 hours, and they don't sleep on a day-wake, day-night cycle as much. By 8.5 months, she should be starting to entrain, but I doubt any of that is going to leave a permanent effect within a week or two if you give good light cues and good feeding cues, because there's more to entraining than just light. Light is the strongest, but when you feed and when you have activity and trains you also, that shouldn't carry over. And if there's a problem months after a change in time zone, then you may be dealing with something which is, you know, either due to some other cause or in some cases even a medical condition.
Thank you for your call.
I would certainly have that looked into.
Chris from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm an exercise movement therapist, and many of my clients are long-haul travelers. And I have found that, without exception, they always, always benefit from an hour-long session of what I'd best describe as yoga-like exercise. So I was wondering if either Dr. Rappaport or Dr. Gregory are familiar with the study that was done at the University of Toronto in 2009 with some sort of nocturnal rodent, like a golden hamster, and disturbed its circadian rhythms, and then found that then when they put the hamsters back on their little hamster wheels, they did much better. They made a faster recovery.
Well, how many hamsters are flying regularly in jets? Is that a problem?
I'm not familiar with the particular study you're referring to, but it is known that, and I'm not surprised at the result, that activity or exercise in the extreme and probably relaxation would also play a role, because it's a lesser activity, are very important cues. And given at the right time, they have tremendous effects. In fact, one of the problems we run into is people who exercise late in the evening before going to bed find they can't go to sleep. So that's a cause of insomnia. That's because it's acting through the many factors that control our rest activity cycle and sleep-wake cycle. So I'm not surprised that, given at the right time, and generally we say, you know, 2 to 3 hours or more, preferably 4 hours before you go to bed, exercise is actually good. There seems to be a response to it that makes sleep easier long after the exercise, even if you don't push it to extremes of fatigue. So I'm not surprised. And the yoga-like activity, again, may play a role in relaxation. I would imagine that's most effective before you go to sleep. These are all sleep aids we use in other circumstances, and I'm sure that they help and train the cycle in jet lag also, or in time change because they are cues to the body.
Now, Tom left a comment on our show page. He says, avoid eating on flights that cross several time zones. Eating only reinforces the body's inner clock, making it more difficult to adjust to the time zone in which you arrive. Is that true, Kevin? Because I think that we expect to be given a meal if we're going to go on a transatlantic flight, aren't we?
Right. Yeah, well, that's like your earlier comment about drinking wine at 10 o'clock in the morning. It is a question how that affects you. I mean, part of it is that entrainment that we were just talking about, that you're used to doing certain things. It's exercise or it's eating at certain times. That can help you adjust to a new time. One of the things we typically talk to people about, jet lag, especially with shift workers as well, is that you should, you know, keep the meal kind of appropriate to the time of day. So maybe a lighter meal when your body's still thinking it's late night or something like that, even if you're about to arrive in London or something like that. So,
well, but should you eat a meal appropriate to the time zone? In other words, you arrive in England just in time after you get your bags into your hotel to have dinner. Do you just go and have a dinner and make believe that you've been living in London for the last 2 years?
I mean, I think there's some, you know, there's that kind of that mental cue that's what time of day it is now. Maybe there's kind of coming up with a balance where you're not eating. If your stomach isn't really ready for a heavy meal, you probably shouldn't try to do that.
Yeah. I think the important thing is that this depends a little bit on how big a time change we're talking about. If you're traveling from New York to California for a three-hour time change, then I think a meal taken at California time, when you are in California, is probably going to help entrain you. If you're traveling a huge distance and that seems unreasonable, so if you're traveling to China or to Australia from New York and there's a 12-hour time zone change and you force yourself to eat a meal at what to your body feels as early in the morning, and you have a big, huge dinner, that may cause upset stomach and other problems. So I think the key is you want to try as close as possible to do, as Kevin just said, what is appropriate to the new time zone. That includes timing of meals, timing of exercise, and, of course, the most important one is timing of light. So you want bright light in what is the new morning, and you want to minimize the light that you get either artificial or real in the evening, because your clock is still trying to behave like it's in the old time zone, and you want to force it to accept the new rules.
Isn't there some research going on related to the ID2 gene, which at least in mice was found to diminish the symptoms of jet lag when it was removed? Do either of you know about that?
I'm not sure I can comment on that.
No, neither can I.
But I've also heard about that Viagra. There have been tests with hamsters that have found that it's effective at reducing the effects of jet lag. We're not going to talk about the other effects, but have you heard about that?
Yes, that was a couple of years ago, and made a big splash. Actually, it came out just before the annual sleep meetings, and there was a fair amount of buzz about that. I can't say that I've heard a lot of follow-up on it, but one of the things that was being done in that was Viagra, among other things, affects parts of the brain, and those parts of the brain, in fact, have relationship to the timing mechanism. So there's a biological basis for it. I can't say that it's entered common practice.
We have a comment from a listener, Joe from New York, wrote on our show page, my cousin was a jet pilot for over 13 years on a commercial airliner, and she said that engine thrust, depending on velocity and direction, had an effect, and pilots would routinely accelerate or decelerate depending on direction to reduce jet lag effects for themselves and the crew. Also, she said the crew would often just not sleep overnight to counteract the effect.
I can't say I've heard of the engine thrust idea before, but I meant sometimes it's just a more of changing when you're flying a long distance, just that regular drone of the engines, perhaps just a change of noise and vibration can help maybe revitalize the pilots a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that there's a difference between changing the jet lag, if by that you mean the way the body is behaving, and the perception of it. the tiredness and fatigue that we experience. So if you've had a bad night, you are sleep deprived. You have that sleep pressure building up. We can fight that. For example, pinching yourself and walking around and so on will make you feel less sleepy, but it doesn't necessarily have a lasting effect. And in boring situations, that comes out dramatically. We actually have a test in the medical field, the multiple sleep latency test, where we put people in a quiet environment, and we see how long it takes them to fall asleep to measure how much sleep pressure there is, and we don't allow them to do those very things. I suspect the thrusting, the change in the thrust of the plane and so on, the stimulation, is just to prevent the monotony. What that's doing is not so much changing the jet lag as it's changing the sleepiness that the person feels by stimulating them. I suspect doing a crossword puzzle might, you know, have a similar effect.
I want to talk about thrusting. I want to get back to the Viagra for a second. Would it work for women as well as men?
It probably would for this use. It has really little to do with its other use. Viagra is used for a lot of things. It's also used for blood pressure in the pulmonary circulation. It affects a specific chemical in the blood, and that chemical seems to be present in the brain in areas that control circadian rhythm.
We have a call from Elise from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I was curious because I spent the winter in Antarctica, actually their summer, our winter. So it was light 24 hours. I was wondering if you had done studies on people there because they, you know, have to go through both 24 hours of light and 24 hours of dark.
Well, what was your experience?
My experience was, for some reason, I slept very well there, aside from the fact that the sun would come shining into my tent. Most of the time I was living in a tent at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd have to look at my watch because otherwise I'd have no idea what time it was, but I'd go right back to sleep. A lot of people felt they had to sleep with a hood or they'd put, you know, a blanket over everything so it would be dark, but I adjusted. Other people had much more difficulty.
Well, exhaustion will be a factor, and also some people just sleep better than others, don't they?
There's no question that some people are able to sleep, you know, very easily and even relatively, you know, contrary circumstances. The general recommendation we make for people in climates or countries where there's this round-the-clock sunlight is to enforce darkness. If you go to Iceland, for example, and I suspect in Alaska, all the hotels have blackout shades for this exact reason. They want you to have dark. That will prevent the people who are susceptible from having the problem. But as I mentioned before, everybody reacts very differently, and you may just be one of the relatively lucky ones who doesn't have this problem, who can sleep, you know, on cue or at least when your body tells it to, and not suffer the effects of light. However, the majority of us are not so lucky.
Now, just we have 10 seconds left, but we were wondering about the effect of all of this on the miners in Chile who have no light, have high stress. Is stress a factor?
Well, stress is a factor in sleep, and that would be affecting them. In fact, many of the research studies on circadian rhythms were done in caves where people intentionally removed all light cues. The early work was done in exactly that way. That's how we measured the internal body clock when there were no cues.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us on today's Please Explain Look at Jet Lag. Dr. David Rappaport, director of the Sleep Medicine Program at NYU Medical School, and Dr. Kevin Gregory, formerly of the NASA Jet Lag Program.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, join guest host Elliot Forrest, who will be speaking with country music singer Marty Stewart. And Marty Stewart will also perform live in our studio. And then members of the Flying Karamazov Brothers discuss their latest performance at Minetta Lane Theater. Plus, Janice Perlman, who's been covering Brazil's favelas for over 40 years, tells us how things have changed over the decades. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Blakey Schick, and Kim Gittleson. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Matt Gurry, Andrew Katchen, Adam Delahanty, and Dan Volpe. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Tune in on Monday and join Elliot Forrest, and then I'll be back on Tuesday.